the mechanics of conducting business, the organization in a mechanical sense, as distinguished from the output. I think they believed that these large and disorderly and impassioned meetings, many of whom were dominated by more radical speakers who liked to do most of the talking and ranting and pretty extreme cases in some instances. I think they thought that this was the kind of a thing that should not represent the faculty, that they came to the wrong decisions and they certainly created the wrong impression. We needed something more respectable and more reliable. And in a sense, what this means is a sort of a distrust of the faculty. And I guess my position most of it has been that you put up with a lot of this disorder if you keep people involved. And but these some people were very strong on the Senate. Gene Cameron was one of these. Gene Cameron and Phil Cohen both, to my knowledge, and there were many others. I'm not really so sure about David Feldman, because David Feldman came from the old tradition. And he had quite a great deal of respect for the old faculty meetings. Now, maybe he thought we should have a Senate, I don't know. But I would say basically there was a group of older and quite conservative, conventional people who were very strong for the idea of a Senate. And I think it was part to avoid letting the power and the glory and at least the noise go in directions that they really didn't approve of. So there was a talk about the Senate. It came up in Gene Cameron's administration, because I remember he had a committee of the whole meeting. This was before we got very far into the disorders to talk about the feasibility of a Senate system. It came up more after we had these big meetings. And I remember one time, I was one of the people who was holding back on the Senate thing.
Oh, you were?
Oh, yeah, sure. And I recall one faculty meeting, or no, one university committee meeting, where, see, both Gene Cameron, who was a former chairman, and Phil Cohen, who succeeded me as chairman, were members of the committee. They came in with a motion which you adopted and passed just like that, which was to move ahead with the development of the Senate idea. And I think they figured this was working around me, because I must have been one of the obstacles. And incidentally, I still, you see, tend to list the Senate as being one of the things that's affected the rule of the faculty. Well, we adopted the faculty. We adopted the faculty Senate idea. They went. This came in the year after I was chairman of the university committee, when Phil Cohen was chairman. They worked out proposals for the Senate. I guess the arguments, I'm not really sure at this stage what the arguments were, but there was always the talk about getting a representative body. Well, I don't know whether I ever heard Dave Feldman use this or not, because I think most political scientists would say that everybody is representative of something. And what we had before, as you said, the kinds of meetings where those who were interested came, that was a self-selected body of interested people, you see, selected that way. But what they were talking about and what really developed was a body of elected voters, I guess you'd say, or people who were elected to represent you in some kind of a legislative capacity, the only people who then have the capacity, the right to make motions and to vote and so on, which is what the Senate does. And we got this. Well, now the immediate effect, and I would say this didn't take 3 minutes to show up, the immediate effect was a great decline in the quality of the debate. And this was apparent from the first meetings on. One of the great advantages of this self-selected sort of a group is that the people on a particular issue that was scheduled to come up, the people who had an interest in that, whether it was pro or con, were there. And they were there to represent their viewpoints, and you had good speeches on both sides.
the South Selected Group selected on the basis of what was going to be talked about.
So you really had the people with interests and knowledge and a case to make turn out, and it would be a different group from one time to another. There were, of course, I suppose Mark Ingram has mentioned this, there were, of course, some people who were very good citizens, faculty citizens, who went to all the faculty meetings as a matter of course, as not a matter of obligation. So you had a core of the old soldiers who were there every time, but the rest of them were a shifting body. Now on the Senate, you have the same people coming every time. And when a particular question comes up before the Senate, you have only the expertise that is in that body of about the tenth the size of the faculty, you see. And you may not have in that body anybody at all who knows anything about that particular subject, although there may be dozens of them elsewhere. They're not there, you see, not in the meeting. Well, the quality of debate has dropped. And I don't think it has appreciably changed any. In theory, you see, the Senate is a body that is going to continue on, so you have the same man there month after month at these regular meetings, and he does pick up knowledge, there's no question about that. But on the other hand, it's a changing body, too. So while I suppose the level of knowledge of the Senate tends to rise to a certain point, it never gets above it because you have this continual change in membership. And anything that doesn't happen this year is something you don't know anything about, if you see what I mean. Mm-hmm. Well, this is one of the things that happened. The meetings became very much more orderly, which was one of the objects. Now, as the people represented, we started off... I think there was a considerable suspicion on the part of the people who were strongly for the Senate. No, excuse me, I put that wrong. The people that were thought they were going to be excluded by the Senate, I think had a considerable suspicion of the motives of the people who were pushing it, and I think they were probably justified. To begin with, then, you see, we got on this question of who was going to get elected. There was a very great pressure, I think, for the young people, some of the young people with non-traditional ideas. I think they made every effort to try to get on, to get elected to the Senate, you see, and I suppose the conventional people wanted to keep them off. I think one of the sorry things about the Senate idea was that we had a lot of people, that the Senate idea was pushed by a lot of people who didn't come to faculty meetings. These were people who didn't really want to get involved, didn't want to come, didn't want to devote their time. And I'd say this is true of many of the people in the sciences. The vocal ones, the ones who came more often, were from LNS and from the humanities and social sciences and so on. But the doctors didn't show up hardly at all, but they were all disturbed about it being represented by a bunch of radicals, you see, a bunch of historians or teachers of English or something like that. And I think one of the reasons they wanted the Senate was so they could do exactly what they did do. They elect somebody to go to the Senate and then they forget about it. It's now in good hands, you see, so that you don't worry about it being taken in the wrong direction. But the push, but who's to get elected? I think the competition was very strong to begin with. As the years went on, and this has not been such a very long time, you see, a matter of 7 years, something mm-hmm. like that, but after a year or two, the advantages of being a member of the Senate as a means of getting your views expressed appeared to diminish, so there was much less desire for people to get on there. We ran into... I was supposed to, as secretary, to kind of supervise in a way the elections to the Senate. And there were many departments where they didn't have enough people who were running for office to have an election. This has been common. It became a matter of, not very great interest to the department who were their representatives. You wanted to have enough senators so that you filled out your quota, In the economics department, for instance, I recall one of my friends saying that he'd been proposed to run for election as a senator, and the chairman had said, well, no, we don't want you to run for election because we've got just enough people now already nominated to fill the seats, and if you don't run, we won't have to have an election. And he didn't. And they, in effect, these were people that were sort of self-appointed to become the senators. Now, and more recently, we've got departments that don't even elect their senators, and we're sending them notes saying, you're not represented, your senator is no longer a senator, and there's a vacancy here, and hold an election, let us know, and they don't respond. So I suppose at any time we can find two or three departments that have, for months, neglected to even to appoint anybody, to elect them. Technically, to elect them. We have a number of departments where it's become kind of common practice. They say, well, we got a new assistant professor, and one of the things he ought to do to learn his way around is to be our... You tell him he has to be the senator, because nobody else wants to do this sort of thing. The old hands dropped off very quickly.
Is this because they felt they weren't having the kind of influence that they'd looked for?
I don't know. The first elections, you see, as soon as the Senate was elected, these people who used to come because they wanted to come, because they were interested in what was going on, they quit coming. And so I suppose you have a number of cases where people just simply were not elected as senators, so they didn't come. I don't know whether Dick Hartshorn ever came to another faculty meeting after we had a Senate. And he, of course, was one who was always there in all of these.
Oh, yes, he was very involved.
Dave Fellman became a senator more recently. In recent years, Dave Fellman has been a senator, and he comes regularly and behaves as a senator should. But anyway, there was a great falling off. I've talked to Glenn Pound about this. I said, Glenn, you know, you used to come to all the faculty meetings. I think the deans, you see, were excluded by any plans for the Senate. They were, they're not members. They're not members. They're members. Members without a vote or something like that. I mean, it's set aside as administrators, you see. Glenn Pound used to come to all the meetings and take quite an active role. And I told him one time, I hadn't seen him at a Senate meeting for a long time. He told me he didn't come to them very often. There's usually somebody comes over to see what's going on. But it's been this kind of a thing. Now, the quality of debate, you see, is also, I think the quality of debate is important from the viewpoint of keeping you interested in these affairs. It was kind of a stirring thing to go to a meeting and hear both sides well presented and have a feeling you were getting information and viewpoints and having to make up your mind on the basis of what was presented there. Now, when it drops off, when you have a poor presentation of one side or no presentation at all, it's kind of a painful thing. It's also pretty boring. And I'm not sure whether the quality of the decisions made isn't reflected by this to some extent. Where in the hell is that? Well, a lot of other things have been working on us at the same time. I do not know how in the extent to which authority has been taken away from the faculty so that they really don't have as much to work on by way of questions of substance, you see. And I think this is quite true. I mean, many things have been decided. They're decided either administratively or they're decided by central administration of the merger system without involving us. I made some studies. When we were talking about the Senate here several years ago and the question of whether to renew it and all, I made some studies in which I compared the agendas over a period of time. I got the agendas pretty well organized. I mean, my tendency is to get them pretty well organized so that they're nice numbered items and easy to identify and so on. And so what I did was go through the agendas and see how many items of business had been taken up at all at a certain meeting. How many of those were matters of routine, no vote taken, what we call automatic consent and things like that. Mm-hmm. How many of them were simply reports in which there was no action to be taken by the Senate? They deliver a report and your action may be to file a report and things of that sort, mm-hmm. that are more for information than for something else, and then trying to come down with a figure that represented the actions that, of matters of real substance, where you are making a decision on something, where you really are asked to make a decision, where you have to vote yes or no.
Mm-hmm.
And that has declined by about half since the Senate began. And I think it was about the lowest last year that it's ever been. One of the reasons I think the Senate has sort of declined in its appeal to people is that you don't really do very much in it. You get mixed up in some of the same things over and over again, but some of these burning questions, like whether to go to the Rose Bowl or whether to discontinue boxing or parking, and some of those have kind of diminished. Now there's something else again. You have these people who come to a Senate meeting dutifully. They're elected to do so, and they may or may not know anything about the subjects that are brought up. So you have that kind of an effect. Now, under the old system, the Chancellor's Administrative Council made up the agenda. This seems kind of odd, I suppose, but here's a bunch of deans that sit around the table, and every month I'd bring in the list of items that were supposed to be on the agenda, and they'd look it over and approve it. And it was fairly routine, but when there was something serious, I recall meetings in which we would work over this to do the very best to stage them. Stage a faculty meeting at which all of the information was presented. And the deans would sit there and they'd say, now who can we get to present this side? We ought to ask him. What we did was try to set them up and actually to arrange, if people didn't volunteer, we went out to get people to be sure that all the sides were presented. Back in those days, it was written into the regulations. All of the documents that went out, basically they had to be approved by the secretary as being complete and presenting information and in a form that you could act on expeditiously and a few things like that. So we actually were quite concerned on these great issues to be sure that both sides were presented and so on. Well, one of the things that happened with the Senate was that the University Committee was designated as the Executive Committee for the Senate. And the University Committee makes up the agenda. The University Committee is also involved in these items on the agenda. So they take up the issues and they discuss them, and they decide on the University Committee position, and then they put it on the agenda and they present it. And it's actually been rather painful for me sometimes to sit there to listen to these senators kind of talk about an issue that's been presented by the University Committee. And you have a feeling that they're casting around, they think there's something wrong with this, but they don't know what it is, and they don't know how to answer the question. The question ought to be, from the floor, ought to be, well, now, is there anybody in opposition to this proposal that you're bringing in there? I suppose this would tend to smoke out some of these things. But the University Committee, in this new role, is both the they have a partisan interest in many of these questions that are coming up, and they present one side, and they present that pretty well. But you may not hear anything at all about the opposition to it. And so, in a sense, you're using the Senate as a sort of a rubber stamp on many of these things. And I think the Senate knows it. They get upset about it. It did not bother us to begin with, because when we first adopted the Senate plan, it provided in there the University Committee was supposed to be the Executive Committee and had this responsibility for the agenda. Well, the University Committees for a while continued to operate the way we always had in the past. That is, they said, as a matter of fact, I would make up the agenda more than anybody else, because the information would come into me, and I'd put it together in a rough form, and I'd go and talk to them, and they'd give their okay. They didn't really get very much involved, unless it was an issue on which the University Committee was already involved, in which they had a stake. But I'd say that two-thirds of the items on the agenda were ones in which the University Committee did didn't have a position. They did not discuss it, did not want to do it. And it was only after several years that the notion of being an executive committee really sort of switched around to the notion of doing these things and really getting yourself wearing this in this dual role of having a partisan interest in the things that you're also supposed to bring to the Senate for debate. That's only, I think what it does is reflect the fact that the university committee doesn't really have a very long tradition. After a matter of two or three years, well, you don't know what happened, don't know what happened before then.
You've touched on that a bit.
But it's been, I'd say it's been since, it's difficult to put just exactly your finger on when this, but in the last 4 years, say, the university committee is pretty well run and they've been in this position. And in the most extreme cases, and there have been some that I thought were quite obvious, the university committee's role toward the faculty senate was about the same as the board of directors of the credit union is toward its constituents. Now, I was chairman of the board of directors of the university credit union at one time, and what we would have to do every year was to have a meeting of the electorate, and we'd have a big meeting. We'd present some reports as quickly and smoothly as possible, and as quick as possible get a vote of approval and adjourn to have coffee and cookies or something like that, you know, afterward. You use it as a kind of a, the executive committee does the deciding, makes the decisions, and you get a kind of confirming vote here, and that's a lot different from the old faculty senate, faculty meetings where we would bring the faculty together and they'd argue it out among themselves and meet you and reach some kind of a decision. And I think this has diminished the role of the Senate. I don't know how many people feel they participate in faculty government around here. All kinds of funny things come out of the Senate and we have a terrible time. We struggle with them and people get all concerned, but I don't know how many people feel that they really are involved in the operations of faculty government, make the decisions in the name of faculty government. One of the things that's happened to faculty, I think, is kind of a, I suppose it's not so much a distrust of itself as a fragmentation and a distrust of some people in the faculty. Dave Fellman, I think, represents a generation in which the Senate, before the Senate, in which the faculty was a group of gentlemen who had considerable respect for other gentlemen. They respected the other view and they were courteous and they trusted them because, after all, if you're a member of the club, well, you're a member of the club and this sort of thing. Maybe beginning with the disorders, and I don't go back any further than that, of course, but beginning with the disorders, we began to feel that some of these, some people could not be trusted very much. And so what you try to do is to work around them and to keep them from being your representatives.
What do you mean they couldn't be trusted?
Well, I think a lot of the conservative people felt that here are these young radicals. What are they doing running around in sweaters and joining with the students in their demonstrations and encouraging them to stay away on when they have a black student strike and things like that, you see. I mean, you certainly didn't want those guys in a very controlling position. So the Senate, I think, was a reaction to that. To keep them out. Now, there have been other cases. Now, incidentally, when we set up the Senate, I think because we had these people who were making themselves heard a lot, whether they really controlled many votes or not, there was a provision in the Senate structure for piling your votes, for using your votes as you wish, in a way that would permit a kind of a minority candidate, people who didn't really command a majority vote in the department, permitting them to seat their people. In other words, it's a vote. If a department is electing three people, three senators, a department of say 30, where ordinarily they would be entitled to three senators, every person who votes in this election, it has three votes, and they can put them all on one person. So that if you scattered your votes uniformly, you'd have three votes, one on each man. But if you put them all, you could give three votes to one man.
Mm-hmm.
And this has permitted some, I mean, this was intended, I think, to permit some people, some of these, I use minority in a different sense here, but people who don't command a majority of the votes to get in. So it's been difficult to try to figure out this sort of a relationship. But we had, at one stage, Anatole Beck got elected to the university committee. Now, Anatole was known as one of the radicals. I guess he still is, although an aging radical, you know, begins to have a sort of a different appearance to it. Anatole was one of the speech makers in the some of the radical ideas, the untypical ones, and so on. And he got on the university committee, I think. I mean, this was a deliberate campaign, I think, among certain groups to like United Faculty and so on, to get their people on it. Anatole Beck got on the university committee. Very soon thereafter, we changed the faculty rules so as to always have a primary election if there are more than two people for a given vacancy. This came out of, I think this was prompted by that kind of a situation, because you didn't want to get somebody like Anatole elected because you can simply put up so many candidates here that a determined few can manage to elect their people. So now we have primary elections, which I think was devised for that. I thought this was kind of a shameful episode, in a sense. I was called in to talk to the university committee about a problem. In those days, I've forgotten what it was. There were five of them there, and we talked about it, and they had a solution, and I said, well, I knew these people and how they reacted on some of these things, so I said, well, how does Anatole feel about this? They said they hadn't told Anatole what they were proposing. This was five of the six members of the university committee. They hadn't told him. So with my talent for making myself beloved, I immediately got up and walked out. I said, I won't have any part of this meeting if you're going to talk to me as university committee and you're excluding some of your members. But this may not be quite as much of a problem. Now, as I say, maybe the scope of faculty authority has been restricted enough so that it's no longer so important whether you get on the university committee or you are a part of some of these things. There was an earlier sort of manifestation of this thing that I'm talking about, and I don't really know how to get hold of it. In the time of the disorders, this was when we had a faculty university faculty assembly. This was before we had the merge system, but when we had a mini merge system with the people from Milwaukee and Parkside and so on, the Fred Harrington version of the merge system. There were two levels of government. One of them was the faculty of the institution itself. And the other one was the faculty assembly, which was an elected body that represented all of the campuses, all of these six different institutions. And it was a very funny setup. I don't know who invented this. I think this was Fred Harrington's system. We finally got rid of it because it doesn't make sense to me in any kind of an organizational way. The faculty assembly representing all of the institutions, composed of representatives that were elected quite independently of anybody else representing the institution. So you had people at that stage who had the local faculty as a body, but they didn't have anything to do with the choice of the faculty assembly representative.
Who did?
They were chosen in a separate election. A separate election went through. So I guess you'd say the faculty did. but we had institutions where the university committee and their local faculty senate and the representatives of the university faculty assembly were not only all different people, but they disagreed very violently on some kinds of issues.
Fine.
And nobody had any responsibility for representing the faculty senate to the local faculty senate to the faculty assembly. It was a different and separate body. And they were busy legislating and passing things, resolutions and so on, at that level, presumably representing the faculty. It was all separated from the system below here, which was, I mean, it was a patched up thing. Well, during the disorders, a group of, I'd say just conservative faculty members, I think they called themselves Concerned Faculty for Responsible Government, or some such title, began to have meetings and to organize themselves. They had a resolution that they wanted to put up, and I think, as far as I know, the resolution was all right. But I think it was a resolution that had to do with the proper role of a faculty member in connection with disorders and demonstrations and shutting down the university and things of this sort. It was a pretty conservative sort of a document. And they, by using the rules, they proposed to take this to the faculty assembly, and they did not want it to go to the Madison faculty. And quite clear that if they'd taken it to the Madison faculty, they'd have been defeated roundly with the thing. So what they were going to do was, well, these were all Madison people, you see, and they wanted to take it to the faculty assembly and have the faculty assembly pass it. Well, the assembly was a very weak organization. They only got together once or twice a year. They came from a lot of different backgrounds. They didn't know each other's situation. They didn't know each other and all that sort of thing. And they were, that was a pretty much of a rubber stamp outfit if there was one, you see. I mean, two aggressive people could go into that and pass almost anything, you see. We stopped that. I mean, when we found out about that, I guess I don't want to credit anybody else or blame anybody else for this sort of thing. I know I was greatly offended by this, and I did everything I could to say that you cannot take something that deals with a local situation to another body and have it done here without giving us a crack at it. But this was a very respectable body of faculty members. I think Dave Feldman was a member, Gene Cameron was a member, Steve Cleaney was a member. I guess I was chairman of the university committee at the time, and I took advantage of my position in that respect to denounce this as an effort to evade the judgment of our own faculty in order to get some kind of a thing passed and give it some kind of recognition. But I think it again comes back to a sense of sort of distrusting your own faculty. I guess I felt this way about the Senate, and when I say this is its role, it's because they have taken the vote away from a lot of people, and they've centered it into a group that is a little more reliable, and so that the other ones can forget about faculty government and have it taken care of. And I think it has affected this. Perhaps particularly since the legislative body, the people with the eventual votes, have sort of been reduced to a position of agreeing to what has already been decided at some other level, like the university committee sort of a role in this matter, which I sort of disapprove of. We have never done it that way. This faculty assembly had some characteristics that were quite unique. They legislated in the name of the faculty, or in the name of the faculties of these six separate institutions. But they did not. They were not very good at telling the faculty what they were going to legislate about. They were in the. Our provisions have always been that agendas and all the documents and all the business to come before a meeting of any kind, like a faculty meeting or a Senate meeting, go to all members of the faculty, because this is business being conducted in the name of all members of the faculty. Well, the assembly did the same thing, except that they would get crowded. And I know, as a secretary, I know the problem they got into. The people who were supposed to write these documents wouldn't get them done in time. But the agendas and all the documents of assembly meetings were getting later and later at a time and delayed so much there was no way in which a member of the faculty could arrange to be represented the way he wanted to at one of these meetings. And Bri Curl was the Vice Chancellor for Academic Affairs at this time. And he was very much concerned about this. We were talking about the, basically we were concerned about how you get representative government without telling the people who are being represented what's going on. And I think at one stage he and I and some others raised enough fuss so that we managed to get the assembly, we managed to prevent the assembly from holding a meeting without letting the faculty know in advance what the meeting was going to be about. Now, Bri was always concerned about this matter of representation. And I used to talk with him, work with him. He was one of the people who was in this matter I just spoke of, who managed to stop that that sort of thing. Taking a resolution that ought to go to our own faculty, taking it to some other body because you didn't think our own faculty would buy it, and you thought the others might. He was one of the people that I always thought had very good ideas about the role of faculty government. We've been talking about the changing and declining role of the faculty, and I think I would also say that it's due in considerable part to a subtle change or a number of changes in the way the faculty just has operated as a faculty. I've mentioned the Faculty Senate. Well, you see, in the Faculty Senate, what we did was substitute for the entire faculty of, say, 2,400 people, a group of about 232, I guess was the last count, elected senators. So we've substituted for the big faculty a smaller faculty. Well, at the same time, the Senate now has an executive committee that to some extent does for the Senate some of the things the Senate does for the faculty. That is, as I've said and tried in various ways to say, that it has acted more like a board of directors, making many of the decisions and deciding on how things should be done and then going to the Senate for some kind of a confirmation or ratification every now and then.
Now, you're talking about the University Committee?
I'm talking about the University Committee, which is the Executive Committee. Now, the faculty never had an Executive Committee. When the Senate was established, the idea of an Executive Committee was built into the legislation, and nobody knew what an Executive Committee did since we'd never had one. And so we continued on pretty much the way we had before, and the University Committee didn't really act very much like an Executive Committee until recent years. And I guess I would put the period in which Clara Penniman acted was chairman of the University Committee, which I think was 73-74. It's a time when they sort of switched directions and became a good deal more of an executive committee or took a director's position with respect to the Senate. Now, this is pretty difficult to document because the change was by small degrees and small things and that rather than anything very large. But as an example, tell you how the Senate operates these days. One time when Ted Finneman, who succeeded Clara as chairman of the University Committee, Ted Finneman as chairman talked over the plans for the next Senate meeting with a group that always meets before the Senate. Before the Senate meetings, it has been our practice for the chairman of the University Committee, the chancellor, the secretary of the faculty, the parliamentarian, and sometimes others, to meet together to go over the prospective meeting. And it was not until that time, or very soon before it, that it was made known outside the university committee circles they had an item of business, a re- uh, Recommendation with respect to the organization of the academic personnel. Academic personnel being the non-faculty, non-classified people, a bigger group than the faculty itself, of course. Now, this was never organized. The faculty was always organized. The non-faculty people, not the classified civil service people, but the rest of them, these other 3,500 people or thereabouts, including a great variety of appointees, including yourself, I should imagine.
Yes, indeed.
They never were organized, and they got interested in this, and the more of a demand for it. As a matter of fact, I think many of the people in the non-faculty group, in this, and now called the academic personnel, have more or less resented the authority that the faculty's had, because the faculty's been organized, and you listen to the faculty, and then here are these people, many of whom do very much the same kind of job as the faculty members do, who aren't organized and don't have a chance to be heard. Anyway, there's been a pressure for that. And this proposal, coming out of the university committee, was a recommendation to the chancellor on how you should organize them, how you should pick the committee. Basically, it was how they pick some kind of a governing committee. Well, when this idea surfaced, and then Ted came to this meeting, well, everybody jumped on him good. There were a lot of, everybody thought of bum idea, thought it was a bum idea in many respects. I've forgotten what the parliamentarian was hot about, or maybe, but we more or less agreed on a number of things. Serena Ponderman was part of this, as a matter of fact, and she agreed on this one. One of the objections we had to it was a kind of a political one. When the Senate was originally organized, there was considerable pressure from outside, I would say, mainly, to make this a university Senate and not a faculty Senate. By a university Senate, they really mean a body that could speak as a Senate, that was composed mainly of faculty perhaps, but it also had other kinds of representatives. The students were always very anxious to get members in this Senate because this seemed to exert a lot of power. And there was the regents were always interested in this, and I'm not even sure the regents didn't want people in there, or they at least at various times they talked about certainly adding students and very surely adding a lot of these people from adding some representatives from this other group I was speaking of, the academic. I mean, after all, you're talking about lecturers and you're talking about TAs and you're talking about a lot of people who are deeply involved in the educational programs. Well, this was beat back. As a matter of fact, it was beat back so successfully. We made this so strongly a faculty senate that they did not even permit deans, and now that I think about it, they didn't permit the secretary of the faculty to be a member of the Senate. See, and I recall remonstrating with the university committee at the time, saying that I ought to be, because you ordinarily choose your secretary from one of your own members and all that sort of thing, and they just refused to do anything about that. So it was exclusively a faculty senate.
Why did they refuse to have the secretary of the faculty?
Oh, I don't know. There may be personalities involved, and there may be a lot of things. You see, they didn't want... I mean, this was a time when the faculty was beginning to look with deep suspicion on anybody in administration. And, I'm a member of the administration. So are the deans. Now, we're all professors. We've been professors longer than most of the people on the university committee, you see, and all that, but they still rule you out.
You crossed over to the other side.
Yeah, well... Anyway, this when we set up the Senate, there was a big argument about making making this a university Senate, not a.
To keep the academic people out.
I mean, the real point was that this was not any business of the faculty Senate, not any business of the university committee. The university committee does not in any way represent the academic personnel, and we were just meddling in there, telling them how to run their show and refusing them to have any role in our own, you see. And I remember Serena was worried about that one at the time, and I thought this was as a matter of principle, this was a very serious defect. Well, they had some other defects in this proposal. And as I said, we jumped all over Ted when we got around the table and talking about this thing. Among other things, they were going to choose the representatives by election. Well, now, election, in my judgment, has gotten to be a very poor way of choosing representatives, because, even in the faculty, where we have elections all the time, most of the people don't know most of the people who are running for office, and they're just, they're confronted with a ballot with some unfamiliar names, and they may choose them because they're in because they're departmental affiliations or something like that, but it isn't a very enlightened way of choosing representatives. And you don't get any balance that way necessarily, because the majority continues to choose representatives that they think are representatives of the majority, and so you don't really get a spread. So one of the arguments against this proposal was that it would be much better to have it appointed, or have it appointed by several different groups. Maybe the chancellor appoints some, and somebody else appoints some, and so on, so that we would get better balance and better selection, and avoid these things. Well, we gave Ted the business on this one pretty good for quite a long time, and he shook his head and he said, "What do I do?" And I and others said, "Well, you simply pull this off the agenda. You've sprung it on us now and didn't tell us, but now take it off and don't carry it any further." And we walked up the hall after that meeting, and Ted says, "You know, I wish I'd never heard of this thing." He was just fed up with it. Well, we got to the Senate meeting. And this was an item on the agenda, down toward the bottom.
It was still on the agenda.
Oh, yeah. You see, we have to print up the agenda and send it out ahead of time. So there's no chance to do anything much about it the day of the meeting or anything like that. At that time, the only thing was for the university committee to pull it off and to say. But Ted was quite unhappy with the whole thing. The Senate meeting went on. As usual, we worked down through the agenda. We got almost to this item, and it began to get close to 5:30. Well, one of the things the Senate does that the old faculty never did, the Senate always quits on time. You can depend on the Senate to quit at 5:30 or 5 minutes before or 5 minutes after, no matter what the business is. They just, and I think this is a good thing. You go until you run, used up your time, and then you quit. But we got down to, say, 5:25 or something like that, and the next item on the agenda was this thing, this misbegotten idea of university committees. And Ted Finman got up, and everybody expected him at that stage to say, "I move to adjourn," because this is what you would ordinarily do, you see, about that time. You move to adjourn, anything on the agenda is carried over, or in which you have another 2 weeks or a month to work on it. We expected him to get up and move to adjourn. Instead, he got up and he moved approval of this recommendation. And he presented it, explained it, said nothing at all about any opposition to it. There was no debate at all in the Senate. There wasn't a word said by anybody. Now, I've got the tapes, you see, on this, so I sometimes go back and check on these things because they're curious. Ted talked, he says, "This is a proposition." Then they called for a vote and it was adopted. There wasn't anybody opposed. And then, as a matter of fact, later on, not that day, but weeks later or something like that, Ted had occasion to refer to this as being the unanimous choice of the Senate, faculty Senate. And I always thought this is the kind of thing that anybody who knew really how it went on there would a very dim view of what the Senate was actually doing. The Senate was, in this case, surely a rubber stamp on this other thing. It was a terrible, I thought it was a bad example. The University Committee is the executive committee of the Senate. It's not the executive committee of the faculty. The faculty never has had one. I suspect that because the University Committee is so closely tied to the Senate, it has a kind of proprietary interest in the darn thing. And I'm sure they would describe the role of the Senate in different terms than I would use if I were saying, "How does the Senate relate to the faculty?" But they think very largely in terms of the Senate rather than in terms of the faculty, which I think is kind of symptomatic of something or other here. At one time, let's see, this was when Ted Finman was chairman of the university committee. He was chairman for 2 years, incidentally. The only person I know of that was chairman for two successive years of the university committee.
How'd that come about?
Well, the university committee chooses their own chairman, and they didn't have anybody else who wanted to be chairman, and Ted wanted to be chairman, so...
So that's happened.
So that's the way it happened. The university committee brought in a proposal, and this was a proposal that we cease... No, I guess it was a proposal that we study, but it was one that was sort of aimed at the idea that we perhaps ought to quit sending the agendas to the members of the faculty. Now, this is a matter of principle, and we've done this for a long time, but you see, we do not make any mailings at all to the Senate itself. There are no mailings, we don't even have a mailing list to the Senate. I expect they'll get one now, but we don't have a mailing list, so we can address things only to the Senate. We send everything to the entire faculty, and the Senate, being members of the faculty, get there that way. Well, the idea, of course, is that this is the business of the faculty, and the Senate are the people who get together and vote on these matters, but the faculty ought to be fully informed. That means that when we send out a mailing, we send out, 2,400 copies or something like that, and sometimes these are the ones that come out in a large brown envelope, and we get complaints because we use new large brown envelopes. Well, we can't do any other way in using machines, and sometimes there's a packet of documents that may be 15, 20 pages, you know, so there's a lot of paper that's involved in sending this around to everybody. Well, the question has come up before, and every now and then I have had, over the years, I've written a letter to somebody or other explaining that, well, this is the reason we think that the faculty should be informed on these things, and we realize there are some people who don't read it, but at least if we don't send it out, nobody can, and so we just do it. No, that this is. But I think Arthur Kellman brought this one into the university committee. Some of his colleagues, and Art is in one of the sciences, thought this was a deplorable waste of paper, and they just hated to throw away these envelopes and all this waste paper. So they were questioning why we send this to all members of the faculty. And the university committee came out with a proposal to set up a committee to study it. Well, this was another one of these proposals that nobody ever saw until it got printed up on the agenda, so you didn't really have any chance to do anything about it. I immediately went in to see the university committee, and I said, in the first place, this is a question that's been hashed over a great deal, and it was discussed when we set up the Senate, and it was an understanding that all members of the faculty were supposed to be told what was going on here and ought to have access to all this information, because after all, they're privileged to come to the meetings and speak to them, you see, and so on. And it was understood that we weren't just giving everything to the Senate and they were going to have a little closed session here and would say, conduct in our name. I think I also said, well, the legislation that provides for the Senate says that the secretary shall send to all members of the faculty. This was part of the legislation to begin with. And it says that I shall send to all members of the faculty. If the Senate had done anything at all along these lines, they could only have taken out that sentence, because they surely would never say that I couldn't send it. And as a matter of fact, I told the university committee, I said, look, I'm the secretary of the faculty as well as secretary of the Senate, and it's my job as secretary, I envisioned my job as a secretary of the faculty to see everybody gets it, so I'm damn well going to continue to do it, whether you tell me otherwise or not, because this isn't your business, it's mine. Well, this proposal came to the Senate, and this was one time when they rose up almost en masse and just overwhelmed the university committee. They voted this one down, right? I mean, everybody was opposed. I mean, a great many people were opposed, and spoke very effectively. They got into the question of the cost and so on. I did not overstate the cost of the sending this out. I mean, if anything, I faked the cost a little bit, but many of us felt very strongly that this should continue. Well, all I say that this, the very fact that this comes out of the university committee, this kind of proposal, I think reflects a viewpoint on their part. They really aren't so sure about the rest of the faculty, but they're very strong on the Senate. Well, another aspect of this, our faculty committees are committees of the faculty. They're not committees of the Senate. There is only one committee that's set up now as a committee of the Senate, and this is a TAA negotiations committee. The Senate elects a group of people to sit in on the negotiations, such as are going on now, and sooner or later to report back to the Senate and tell them what the educational or the academic aspects of this are, of the proposed contract, and get their approval or something like that. I mean, this is the only committee that is created by the Senate. The rest of them are called committees of the faculty. Legislation is clear on this. Sometimes people forget. The university committee is quite prone to talk about this being a Senate committee. Well, it isn't a Senate committee, it's a faculty committee, and I'm the kind of a person who watches this in a kind of an editorial sense and corrects it whenever it shows up. Well, now these faculty committees of the faculty, are chosen in a variety of ways. Some of them are elected by the faculty. Some of them are appointed. A great many are appointed. Legislation will provide that there shall be a committee, and sometimes specify the composition and so on, and say these people are to be appointed annually by the chancellor or something like that. So at one stage, and I think this reveals kind of a viewpoint, at one stage the university committee wrote a letter. I guess this was done by Wilson Thede when he was the chairman the year before Clara came. Recommending to the chancellor that he appoint, wherever possible, members of the Senate to these faculty committees. Now, I talked this over with the chancellor, and I had my say on it, and one of the problems when you're appointing committees is it's awfully hard to find the right people and to say that we will now appoint them, make our selections from the Senate, which is only a tenth the size of the faculty, means that you're quite seriously limiting your area of choice and so on. I mean, after all, it's a chancellor's job to appoint the best people he can find and to pick those arbitrarily from a select tenth of the faculty was kind of a little out of keeping. Well, anyway, they asked him to do it. And then about a year later, I guess it was, the same thing surfaced in the university committee. And at that time, Ted Finman sent a letter to all members of the Senate asking them which committees they would like to committees they would like to be appointed to serve on, asking them really to volunteer an interest in a particular committee to be appointed. And these were asking them which of the appointed committees they wanted to be appointed to, which of the committees the chancellor was supposed to appoint that they wanted to be appointed to. Well, this was the same argument over again in a way. Now, the university committee argument, in part, I think, because of preoccupation with the Senate, was that this would make for closer ties between the committee when it came in with its recommendation and the Senate. And I never could see any merit at all to that argument, because most committees operate independently and they don't communicate with the Senate all the way through on every stage. What they do is bring in their final things, and what difference does it make if it's somebody that is in the Senate or somebody from outside? You aren't a party to this. But anyway, university committee had some rationale of this sort in their argument. So they sent around a letter asking people to volunteer themselves. And I immediately sent a letter then to all members of the faculty asking them asking them if they had any interest in these committees. See, because if somebody was going to dig up a lot of names from the Senate, I was going to have an equal... As a matter of fact...
You took this on your own authority.
Oh, yeah, sure, I did this. I suppose this this kind of thing over a period of time reflects on your relationships. As a matter of fact, it's a dumb idea to ask broadside who wants to be on what kinds of committees. This causes you, on the whole, causes you nothing but problems. Because the people who volunteer are people who have an axe to grind on a particular, if you pick people of this sort, you do not get what we hope to get when we have set up a faculty committee, which is kind of a considered judgment, looking at all sides of it, and a bunch of gentlemen who are together here working out some kind of a middle ground that they can recommend then to the faculty or to the Senate. I use gentlemen in the general sense of people who are determined to work together, you see, and that sort of thing, instead of get in there as partisan members. Well, this is sort of typical. I think on the whole, yes, I mean, we didn't ignore this idea. As Ed Young said to me, well, if a man is a member of the Senate, we shouldn't discriminate against him. If he's the best qualified person, why, we should appoint him. But he never, to my knowledge, really bought this idea or gave the university committee very much encouragement on that. He figured that would be one of their measures. Well, now, another aspect of the committees, and this is, I think, again, one of those things that's difficult to evaluate for sure. Committees of the faculty report to the faculty. They don't report to the Senate. I mean, it's written in all our legislation. Now, there's a technicality here. Naturally, committees report. And they report at meetings of the Senate. Those are the only meetings we have. But the committee report, in the traditional view that I guess I represent here, the committee report is addressed to and directed to and given to the faculty as a whole. And
even though it's presented at a Senate meeting.
Even though it's presented at a Senate meeting, it's on the grounds that this is the business of the faculty, and that any member of the faculty is entitled not only to come and speak there, but he certainly is entitled to look at this from his own viewpoint and then go to his senator and tell him how to vote, you see, this sort of thing. Well, now, it's only a technicality. It doesn't really matter, but it's the kind of a thing that the secretary, being in a kind of the documentary flow position here, catches. If I find a faculty committee that heads its thing report to the Senate, why I change Senate to faculty and so on, and nobody really seems to care very much, really see very much difference, although I think it is something. University committee quite frequently, I mean almost always, talks about reporting to the Senate. They don't talk about reporting to the faculty. Well, that's only an editorial thing, one of those matters of preference in the use of the language or something, you see, that makes a difference to a few people. But worse, there is now a tendency for these committees of the faculty, who are supposed to report to the faculty, there's kind of a tendency to think that they ought to report first to the university committee.
Well, where did this idea spring up?
Well, this is a persistent idea. I can go back to these days of Cameron, before my time as chairman of the university committee, when this point was never very clear. Now, you can't ask the body itself to define its own role very well. That is, I shouldn't say that. What I mean is that when you ask the university committee whether the committee should report to the university committee or to somebody else first, why, university committee will always think, well, we really ought to see it first. I mean, this is sort of natural. This is an idea that has cropped up every now and then. It's been corrected sometimes. I think I told you about those two committees, the Sam Merman Committee and the Jim Crow Committee, that reported, and they gave their documents to the University Committee, and the University Committee then put up its version of the recommendations, and we were fought bitterly by these committees and lost when we got to the Senate. I think I mentioned mm-hmm. that. Well, anyway, this is a common thing. I would say that this is the idea of reporting directly to the university committee is contrary to tradition, because every committee worth its salt insists on its own independent authority and its own judgment.
Yes, I would think this would be resisted by the committees.
I would say that the current committee thinks that committee reports should go to the university committee, and the university committee should have a crack at them, including a chance, you see, then to talk to the committee and tell them how to change it and what the university committee will support and so on. I don't think they insist on writing these reports, but they really think that they belong in this stream. And there was a time when the Senate Well, when the documents that we sent out with an agenda, the reports of the committees, many of those were not even shown to the university committee, at least until the reports were solid and being typed up and put in the final form on the documents. I always made a point of letting the university committee know what was being proposed, but they weren't in the chain of people to communicate with. But this distinction is blurred. Well, this distinction is blurred, and it's blurred because our committees are appointed in a great variety of ways. There are, I make some distinctions that probably nobody else worries about, or maybe they wouldn't agree with me. But a committee that is set up by faculty legislation may provide that it be appointed by the university committee, or by the chancellor, or elected, or, I mean, they may pick any one of a number of ways of selecting members of the committee, but if it's set up by faculty legislation, I figure that's a committee of the faculty to report to the faculty. Now, the university committee also has authority to appoint committees on its own. If it decides there's a subject that's of interest, why, they may go out and appoint a committee, and in recent years, I've never known sometimes if they even had a committee on some of these things, but they appoint some committee to make a study of grading practices or something of the sort. They appoint it on their own authority. Now, my distinction would be that that committee should report to the university committee. The university committee has appointed it to study a certain thing, and now they report back to the university committee, and which does what it wants to with that kind of recommendation. So there are these lines, but I'd say the university committee has a general feeling now that all committees should report to it. And I must say, and I'm a little sorry about this, most of the committees agree now. It has become so much a practice that, and I think probably if I were a committee chairman, I would do the same thing. You see, if you work as a committee, it's nice to have the support of the university committee. So what you do is tell them all about what you're doing and get their reaction to your recommendations and try to come out so they will endorse it and push it and all that sort of thing. So, They stand in this chain of decision making authority to a considerable extent.
It seems to give an awful lot of influence to the university committee.
Now, to do justice to the people, I find it difficult to do justice to people in circumstances like this. I would say that the current university committee doesn't really know what it's doing. That is, what it's doing with respect to traditional ways of doing things. The great fall of the university committee had no continuity. Anything that took place more than a year and a half ago, they don't know anything about. So they don't know that they're doing it so much differently than we've always done it. And if they don't make any effort to come around to find out how it was done, or really be very interested in how it was done, well, what they're doing seems perfectly reasonable. And I think I told you earlier, there's a kind of a chronic infection you pick up when you're a member of the university committee. You're told all the time that you're the all-powerful and influential university committee, and you sort of believe that you ought to be in on everything. After a while, you get to this sort of feeling. Well, now, other things that have happened to the faculty. There's that, I think, rather curious situation involving the faculty rules and regulations. I mentioned this the other day. Originally, these were the laws and regulations.